Kiwi, Jordan said, thumping into his seat at the table, and that was all. Whether this was an expression of approval or distaste, Delaney couldn't tell. From the living room came the electronic voice of the morning news. 37 Chinese nationals were drowned early today when a smuggler's ship went aground just east of the Golden Gate Bridge. Outside, beyond the windows, there was another yelp from the dogs. Jordan began to rotate his spoon in the bowl of fruit, a scrape and clatter accompanied by the moist sounds of mastication. Delaney, his back to the table, was scrubbing the counter in the vicinity of the stove, though any splashes of cooking oil or spatters of sauce must have been purely imaginary, since he hadn't actually cooked anything. He scrubbed for the love of scrubbing. "Okay, Buckaroo," he called over his shoulder. "You got two choices today as far as your high-fiber bar is concerned, cranberry nut and boysenberry supreme. What'll it be?" From a mouth laden with kiwi. "Papaya coconut. You got the last one yesterday." No response. "So what'll it be?" Kyra insisted on the full nutritional slate for her son every morning. Fresh fruit, granola with skim milk and brewer's yeast, high-fiber bar. The child needed roughage, vitamins, whole grains, and breakfast, for a growing child at least, was the most important meal of the day, the foundation of all that was to come. That was how she felt. And while Delaney recognized a touch of the autocratic and perhaps even fanatic in the regimen, he by and large subscribed to it. He and Kyra had a lot in common, not only temperamentally, but in terms of their beliefs and ideals, too. That was what had attracted them to each other in the first place. They were both perfectionists, for one thing. They abhorred clutter. They were joggers, non-smokers, social drinkers, and if not full-blown vegetarians, people who were conscious of their intakes of animal fats. Their memberships included the Sierra Club, Save the Children, the National Wildlife Federation, and the Democratic Party. They preferred the contemporary look to early American or kitsch. In religious matters, they were agnostic. Delaney's question remained unanswered, but he was used to cajoling Jordan over his breakfast. He tiptoed across the room to hover behind the boy who was playing with his spoon and chanting something under his breath. Rookie card," Jordan was saying, dipping into his granola without enthusiasm. "No looking now," Delaney warned, seductively tapping a foil-wrapped bar on either side of the boy's thin, wilted neck. "Right hand or left?" Jordan reached up with his left hand, as Delaney knew he would, fastening on the boysenberry supreme bar just as Kyra hunched over the weight of two boxes of hand-addressed envelopes, Excelsior 500 count, clattered into the kitchen in her heels. She made separate kissing motions in the direction of her husband and son, then slid into her chair, poured herself half a cup of coffee lightened with skim milk for the calcium, and began sifting purposively through the envelopes. "Why can't I have sugar pops or honey nut Cheerios like other kids? Or bacon and eggs?" Jordan pinched his voice. "Mom, why can't I?" Kyra gave the stock response. "You're not other kids, that's why." And Delaney was taken back to his own childhood, a rainy night in the middle of an interminable winter, a plate of liver, onions, and boiled potatoes before him. "I hate granola," Jordan countered, and it was like a no-play, timeless ritual. "It's good for you." "Yeah, sure." Jordan made an exaggerated slurping sound, sucking the milk through his teeth. "Think of all the little children who have nothing to eat," Kyra said without looking up, and Jordan, sticking to the script, came right back at her. "Let's send them this." Now she looked up. "Eat," she said, and the drama was over. "Busy day?" Setting Kyra's orange juice down beside the newspaper and unscrewing the childproof caps of the sturdy plastic containers that held her 12 separate vitamin and mineral supplements. He did the little things for her. Out of love and consideration, sure, but also in acknowledgment of the fact that she was the chief breadwinner here, the one who went off to the office while he stayed home. Which was all right by him. He had none of those juvenile macho hang-ups about role reversal and who wore the pants and all of that. Real estate was her life, and he was more than happy to help her with it, so long as he got his 4 hours a day at the keyboard. Kyra lifted her eyebrows but didn't look up. She was tucking what looked to be a small white packet into each of the envelopes in succession. "Busy?" she echoed. "Busy isn't the word for it. I'm presenting two offers this morning, both of them real lowball. I've got a buyer with cold feet on that Calabasas property, with escrow due to close in 8 days. and I'm scheduled for an open house on the Villa Escobar place at 1. Is that the dogs I hear? What are they barking at? Delaney shrugged. Jordan had shucked the foil from his high-fiber bar and was drifting toward the TV room with it, which meant he was going to be late for school if Delaney didn't hustle him out of there within the next 2 minutes. The cat, as yet unfed, rubbed up against Delaney's leg. "I don't know," he said. "They've been yapping since I let them out. Maybe it must be a squirrel or something. Or maybe Jack's dog got loose again and he's out there peeing on the fence and driving them into a frenzy." "Anyway," Kyra went on, "it's going to be hell, and it's Carla Bayer's birthday, so after work a bunch of us. Don't you think this is a cute idea?" She held up one of the packets she'd been stuffing the envelopes with. It was a 3x5 seed packet showing a spray of flowers and printed with the legend, "Forget-me-not, compliments of Kyra Menneker Mossbacher, Mike Bender Realty, Inc." "Yeah, I guess," he murmured, wiping at an imaginary speck on the counter. This was her way of touching base with her clients. Every month or so, usually in connection with a holiday, she went through her mailing list, consisting of anyone she'd ever sold to or for, whether they'd relocated to Nome, Singapore, or Irkutsk, or passed on into the great chain of being, and sent a small reminder of her continued existence and willingness to deal. She called it keeping the avenues open. Delaney reached down to stroke the cat. "But can't one of your secretaries do that sort of thing for you?" "It's the personal touch that counts and moves property. How many times do I have to tell you?" There was a silence, during which Delaney became aware of the cartoon jingle that had replaced the voice of the news in the other room, and then, just as he was clearing Jordan's things for the table and checking the digital display on the microwave for the time, 7:32, the morning fell apart. Or no, it was torn apart by a startled, breathless shriek that rose up from beyond the windows as if out of some primal dream. This was no yip, no yelp, no bark or howl. This was something final and irrevocable, a predatory scream that took the varnish off their souls and it froze them in place. They listened, horrified, as it rose in pitch until it choked off as suddenly as it had begun. The after effect was electric. Kyra bolted up out of her chair, knocking over her coffee cup and scattering envelopes. The cat darted between Delaney's legs and vanished. Delaney dropped the plate on the floor and grasped for the counter like a blind man. And then Jordan was coming through the doorway on staccato feet. His face opened up like a pale nocturnal flower. "Delaney," he gasped, "something, something." But Delaney was already in motion. He flung open the door and shot through the courtyard, head down, rounding the corner of the house just in time to see a dun-colored blur scaling the 6-foot chain-link fence with a tense white form clamped in its jaws. His brain decoded the image. A coyote had somehow managed to get into the enclosure and seize one of the dogs, and there it was, wild nature, up and over the fence as if this were some sort of circus act. Shouting to hear himself, shouting nonsense, Delaney charged across the yard as the remaining dog, Osbert, Sacheverell, cowered in the corner, and the dun blur melded with the buckwheat, chamise, and stiff high grass of the wild hillside that gave onto the wild mountains beyond. He didn't stop to think. In 2 bounds he was atop the fence and dropping to the other side, absently noting the paw prints in the dust, and then he was tearing headlong through the undergrowth, leaping rocks and shrubs and dodging the spines of the yucca plants clustered like breastworks across the slope. He was running, that was all he knew. Branches raked him like claws. Burrs bit into his ankles. He kept going, pursuing a streak of motion, the odd flash of white. Now he saw it, now he didn't. "Hey!" he shouted. "Hey, goddammit!" The hillside sloped sharply upward, rising through the colorless scrub to a clump of walnut trees and jagged basalt outcroppings that looked as if they'd poked through the ground overnight. He saw the thing suddenly, the pointed snout and yellow eyes, the high, stiff, leggy gait as it struggled with its burden, and it was going straight up and into the trees. He shouted again, and this time the shout was answered from below. Glancing over his shoulder, he saw that Kyra was coming up the hill with her long jogger's strides in blouse, skirt, and stocking feet. Even at this distance, he could recognize the look on her face, the grim set of her jaw, the flaring eyes and clamped mouth that spelled doom for whoever got in her way, whether it was a stranger who had locked his dog in a car with the windows rolled up, or the hapless seller who refused a cash-out bid. She was coming, and that spurred him on. If he could only stay close, the coyote would have to drop the dog. It would have to. By the time he reached the trees, his throat was burning. Sweat stung his eyes, and his arms were striped with nicks and scratches. There was no sign of the dog, and he pushed on through the trees to where the slope fell away to the feet of the next hill beyond it. The brush was thicker here, 6 feet high and so tightly interlaced it would have taken a machete to get through it in places. And he knew, despite the drumming in his ears and the glandular rush that had him pacing and whirling and clenching and unclenching his fists, that it was looking bad. Real bad. There were 1,000 bushes out there, 5,000, 10,000, and the coyote could be crouched under any one of them. He was watching him even now, he knew it, watching him out of slit, wary eyes as he jerked back and forth, frantically scanning the mute clutter of leaf, branch, and thorn, and the thought infuriated him. He shouted again, hoping to flush it out. But the coyote was too smart for him. Ears pinned back, jaws and forepaws stifling its prey, it could lie there absolutely motionless for hours. "Osbert!" he called out suddenly, and his voice trailed off into a hopeless bleat. "Sacheverell!" The poor dog, it couldn't have defended itself from a rabbit. Delaney stood on his toes, strained his neck, poked angrily through the nearest bush. Long, low shafts of sunlight fired the leaves in an indifferent display, as they did every morning. And he looked into the illuminated depths of that bush and felt desolate suddenly, empty, cored out with loss and helplessness. "Osbert!" The sun seemed to erupt from him, as if he couldn't control his vocal cords. "Here, boy, come!" Then he shouted Sacheverell's name over and over, but there was no answer except for a distant cry from Kyra, who seemed to be way off to his left now. All at once he wanted to smash something, tear the bushes out of the ground by the roots. This didn't have to happen. It didn't. If it wasn't for those idiots leaving food out for the coyotes as if they were nothing more than sheep with bushy tails and eye teeth. And he'd warned them, time and again, you can't be heedless of your environment. You can't. Just last week he'd found half a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken out back of the DeGolian place, waxy, red and white striped cardboard with a portrait of the grinning chicken killer himself, smiling large. And he'd stood up at the bi-monthly meeting of the Property Owners Association to say something about it. They wouldn't even listen. Coyotes, gophers, yellow jackets, rattlesnakes even. They were a pain in the ass, sure, but nature was the least of their problems. It was humans they were worried about. The Salvadorans, the Mexicans, the blacks, the gangbangers and taggers and carjackers they read about in the metro section over their bran toast and coffee. That's why they'd abandoned the flatlands of the valley and the hills of the west side to live up here, outside the city limits, in the midst of all this scenic splendor. Coyotes? Coyotes were quaint. Little demi-dogs out there howling at the sunset, another amenity like the oaks, the chaparral, and the views. No, all Delaney's neighbors could talk about, back and on, as if it were the key to all existence, was gates. A gate, specifically, to be erected at the main entrance and manned by a 24-hour guard to keep out those very gangbangers, taggers, and carjackers they'd come here to escape. Sure. And now poor Osbert, or Sacheverell, was nothing more than breakfast. The fools. The idiots. Delaney picked up a stick and began to beat methodically at the bushes. The Arroyo Blanco Community Center was located on a knoll overlooking Topanga Canyon Boulevard and the private road, Arroyo Blanco Drive, that snaked off it and wound its way through the oaks and into the grid of streets that comprised the subdivision. It was a single-story white stucco building with an orange tile roof in the Spanish Mission style, and it featured a kitchen, wet bar, stage, PA system, and seating for 200. The hall was full, standing room only, by the time Delaney arrived. He'd been delayed because Kyra had been late getting home from work, and since it was the maid's day off, there'd been no one to watch Jordan. Kyra was in a state. She'd come in the door looking like a refugee, her eyes reddened and a tissue pinned to the tip of her reddened nose, grieving for Sacheverell. Sacheverell it was. She'd been able to identify the surviving dog as Osbert by means of an indisputable mole clinging to his underlip. For an hour or more that morning she'd helped Delaney beat the bushes, frantic, tearful, her breath coming in ragged gasps. She'd had those dogs forever, long before she'd met Delaney, before Jordan was even born. But finally, reluctantly, she'd given it up and gone off to work, where she was already late for her 10 o'clock. She changed her clothes, reapplied her makeup, comforted Jordan as best she could, and dropped him off at school, leaving Delaney with the injunction to find the dog at all cost. Every half hour throughout the day she called him for news, and though he had news by noon, grim, definitive news, news wrapped up in half a dozen paper towels and sequestered even now in the pocket of his windbreaker, he kept it from her, figuring she'd had enough of a jolt for one day. When she came home, he held her for a long moment, murmuring the soft, consolatory things she needed to hear, and then he went in to Jordan, who'd been sent home early from school with chills and fever. It was a sad scene. Just before he left for the meeting, Delaney looked in on them, mother and son, huddled in Jordan's narrow bed, with Osbert and Dame Edith, the cat, looking like survivors of a shipwreck adrift on a raft. Delaney edged in at the rear of the auditorium beside a couple he didn't recognize. The man was in his 40s, but he had the hips and shoulders of a college athlete and looked as if he'd just come back from doing something heroic. The woman, 6 feet tall at least, was around Kyra's age, mid-30s, he guessed, and she was dressed in black Lycra shorts and a USC jersey. She leaned into her husband like a sapling leaning into a rock ledge. Delaney couldn't help noticing the way the shorts cradled the woman's buttocks in a flawless illustration of form and function, but then he recalled the thing in his pocket and looked up into a sea of heads in the harsh white rinse of the fluorescent lights. Jack Jardine was up on the dais, along with Jack Cherrystone, the association secretary, and Linda Portis, the treasurer. The regularly scheduled meeting, the one at which Delaney had stood to warn his neighbors of the dangers of feeding the local fauna, had adjourned past 12 after prolonged debate on the gate issue, and Jack had convened tonight's special session to put it to a vote. Under normal circumstances, Delaney would have stayed home and lost himself in John Muir or Edwin Way Teal, but these were not normal circumstances. Not that he was indifferent to the issue. The gate was an absurdity, intimidating and exclusionary, anti-democratic even, and he'd spoken against it privately. But to his mind, it was a fait accompli. His neighbors were overwhelmingly for it, whipped into a reactionary frenzy by the newspapers and the eyewitness news, and he didn't relish being one of the few dissenting voices, a crank like Rudy Hernandez, who liked to hear himself talk and would argue any side of any issue till everyone in the room was ready to rise up and throttle him. The gate was going up, and there was nothing Delaney could do about it. But he was here, uncomfortably here. Here because tonight he had a private agendum, an agendum that lay hard against his hip in the lower pocket of his windbreaker, and his throat went dry at the thought of it. Someone spoke to the question, but Delaney was so wound up in his thoughts he didn't register what was being said. There would be discussion, and then a vote. And for the rest of his days he'd have to feel like a criminal driving into his own community, excusing himself to some jerk in a crypto-fascist uniform, making special arrangements every time a friend visited or a package needed to be delivered. He thought of the development he'd grown up in. The fenceless expanse of lawns, the shared space, the deep, lush, marshy woods where he'd first discovered ferns, frogs, garter snakes, the whole shining envelope of creation. There was nothing like that anymore. Now there were fences. Now there were gates. "The chair recognizes Doris Obst," Jack Jardine said, his voice riding out over the currents of the room as if he were singing, as if everyone else spoke prose and he alone spoke poetry. The woman who rose from a seat in the left front of the auditorium was of indeterminate age. Her movements were brisk, and the dress clung to the shape of her as if it had been painted on, yet her hair was gray and her skin the dead, bleached, merciless white to the bond paper Delaney used for business letters. Delaney had never laid eyes on her before, and the realization, coupled with the fact that he didn't seem to recognize any of the people he was standing among, produced a faint, uneasy stirring of guilt. He should be more rigorous about attending these meetings, he told himself. He really should. "The cost factor," Doris Obst was saying in a brooding, almost masculine tenor, "because I'm sure there isn't a person in this room that doesn't feel our fees are already astronomical, and I'm just wondering if the board's cost analysis is accurate, or if we're going to be hit with special assessments down the line." "Jim Shirley," Jack sang, and Doris Obst sank into her seat, even as a man rose in the rear, as if they were keys of the same instrument. To his consternation, Delaney didn't recognize this man either. "What about the break-ins?" Jim Shirley demanded, an angry tug to his voice. There was an answering murmur from the crowd, cries of umbrage and assent. Jim Shirley stood tall, a big bearded man in his 50s who looked as if he'd been inflated with a bicycle pump.
Right on my block, Via di Chosa. There have been 2 houses hit in the last month alone. The Caseys lost something like $50,000 worth of Oriental rugs while they were away in Europe, and their home entertainment center, too, not to mention their brand-new Nissan pickup. I don't know how many of you sitting here tonight are familiar with the modus operandi, but what the thieves do is they typically pry open the garage door. There's always a little give in these automatic openers, and they take their sweet time, load your valuables into your own car, and then drive it off as if they were entitled to it. At the Caseys, they even had the gall to broil 6 lobster tails from the freezer and wash them down with a couple bottles of Perrier Jouet.
A buzz went through the crowd, thick with ferment and anger. Even Delaney felt himself momentarily distracted from the bloody evidence in his pocket.
Crime? Up here? Wasn't that what they'd come here to escape? Wasn't that the point of the place?
All of a sudden, the gate didn't sound like such a bad idea.
Delaney was startled when the man beside him, the athlete, thrust up his arm and began to speak even before Jack Jardine had a chance to officially recognize him.
"I can't believe what I'm hearing," the man said,
and his long-legged wife nuzzled closer to him, her eyes shining with pride and moral authority.
"If we'd wanted a gated community, we would have moved to Hidden Hills or Westlake, but we didn't. We wanted an open community, freedom to come and go, and not just for those of us privileged enough to be able to live here, but for anyone, any citizen, rich or poor. I don't know, but I cut my teeth on the 60s, and it goes against my grain to live in a community that closes its streets to somebody just because they don't have as fancy a car as mine or as big a house. I mean, what's next? Wrist bracelets for ID? Metal detectors?"
Jack Cherrystone made an impatient gesture at the president's elbow, and Jack recognized him with a nod.
"Who are we kidding here?" he demanded in a voice that thundered through the speakers like the voice of God on high.
Jack Cherrystone was a little man, barely 5.5 feet tall, but he had the world's biggest voice. He made his living in Hollywood, doing movie trailers, his voice rumbling across America like a fleet of trucks, portentous, fruity, hysterical. Millions of people in theaters from San Pedro to Bangor churned in their seats as they watched the flashing images of sex and mayhem explode across the screen and felt the assault of Jack Cherrystone's thundering wallop of a voice. And his friends and neighbors at Arroyo Blanco Estates sat up a little straighter when he spoke.
"I'm as liberal as anybody in this room. My father chaired Adlai Stevenson's campaign committee, for Christ's sake, but I say we got to put an end to this."
A pause. The whole room was riveted on the little man on the dais. Delaney broke out in a sweat.
"I'd like to open my arms to everybody in the world, no matter how poor they are or what country they come from. I'd like to leave my back door open and the screen door unlatched the way it was when I was a kid. But you know as well as I do that those days are past."
He shook his head sadly.
"L.A. stinks. The world stinks. Why kid ourselves? That's why we're here. That's why we got out. You want to save the world? Go to Calcutta, sign on with Mother Teresa. I say that gate is as necessary, as vital, essential and undo withoutable as the roofs over our heads and the dead bolts on our doors. Face up to it," he rumbled. "Get real, as my daughter says. Really, truly, people. What's the debate?"
Delaney found himself clutching at the thing in his pocket, the bloody relic of that innocent dog, and he couldn't restrain himself any longer, not after the onslaught of Jack Cherrystone's ominous tones, not after the day he'd been through, not after the look on Kyra's face as she slumped across that narrow bed with her son and her terrified pets. His hand shot up.
"Delaney Mossbacher," Jack Jardine crooned.
Faces turned toward him. People craned their necks. The golden couple beside him parted their lips expectantly.
"I just wanted to know," he began,
but before he could gather momentum, someone up front interrupted him with a cry of,
"Louder!"
He cleared his throat and tried to adjust his voice. His heart was hammering.
"I said I just wanted to know how many of you are aware of what feeding the indigenous coyote population means." "Speak to the question," a voice demanded.
An exasperated sigh ran through the audience. Several hands shot up.
"This is no trivial issue," Delaney insisted, staring wildly around him. "My dog! My wife's dog!"
"I'm sorry, Delaney," Jack Jardine said, leaning into the microphone, "but we have a pending question regarding construction and maintenance of a gated entryway, and I'm going to have to ask you to speak to it or yield the floor."
But, Jack, you don't understand what I'm saying. Look, a coyote got into our backyard this morning and took...
Yield the floor, a voice called. Speak to the question or yield.
Delaney was angry suddenly. Angry for the second time that day. Burning, furious. Why wouldn't people listen? Didn't they know what this meant, treating wild carnivores like ducks in the park?
I won't yield, he said,
and the audience began to hiss, and then suddenly he had it in his hand, Sacheverell's gnawed white foreleg with its black stocking of blood, and he was waving it like a sword. He caught a glimpse of the horror-struck faces of the couple beside him as they unconsciously backed away, and he was aware of movement off to his right, and Jack Cherrystone's amplified voice thundering in his ears, but he didn't care. They would listen. They had to.
This, he shouted over the uproar. This is what happens!
Later, as he sat on the steps out front of the community center and let the night cool the sweat from his face, he wondered how he was going to break the news to Kyra. When he'd left her, it was with the lame assurance that the dog might turn up yet. Maybe he'd got away, maybe he was lost. But now, all of Arroyo Blanco knew the grisly finality of Sacheverell's fate. And Delaney had accomplished nothing, absolutely nothing, beyond making a fool of himself. He let out a sigh, throwing back his head and staring up into the bleary pall of the night sky. It had been a rotten day. Nothing accomplished. He hadn't written a word. Hadn't even sat down at his desk. All he'd been able to think about was the dog and the gnawed bit of bone and flesh he'd found in a hole beneath a dusty clump of manzanita. Inside, they were voting. The windows cut holes in the fabric of the night, bright rectilinear slashes against the black backdrop of the mountains. He heard a murmur of voices, the odd scrape and shuffle of hominid activity. He was just about to push himself up and go home when he became aware of a figure hovering at the edge of the steps. "Who is it?" he said.
"It's me, Mr. Mossbacher," came the voice from the shadows,
and then the figure moved into the light cast by the windows, and Delaney saw that it was Jack Jardine's son, Jack Jr. Jack Jr. swayed like a eucalyptus in the wind, a marvel of tensile strength and newly acquired height, long-limbed, big-footed, with hands the size of baseball mitts. He was 18, with mud-brown eyes that gave no definition to the pupils, and he didn't look anything like his father. His hair was red, for one thing, not the pale, wispy carrot-top Delaney had inherited from his Scots-Irish mother, but the deep, shifting auburn you saw on the flanks of horses in an uncertain light. He wore it long on top in a frenzy of curls and shaved to the bone from the crest of his ears down.
"Hello, Jack," Delaney said, and he could hear the weariness in his own voice. "They got one of your dogs, huh?"
"Afraid so," Delaney sighed. "That's what I was trying to tell them in there. You can't feed wild animals. That's about the long and the short of it. But nobody wants to listen."
"Yeah, I know what you mean."
Jack Jr. kicked at something in the dirt with the toe of one of his big leather high tops. In this light, the shoes seemed to grow out of the ground and meld with his body, trunks to anchor the length of him. There was a pause during which Delaney again contemplated pushing himself up and heading home, but he hesitated. Here was a sympathetic ear, an impressionable mind.
"What they don't realize," Delaney began, but before he could finish the thought, Jack Jr. cut him off. "By the way, the other night, when you came to see my father about the Mexican?"
The Mexican. Suddenly, the man's face floated up again to press at the edges of Delaney's consciousness, fill him up like some pregnant ghost with images of rotten teeth and stained mustaches. The Mexican. What with Sacheverell, he'd forgotten all about him. Now he remembered. The boy had been stretched out on the sofa like a recumbent monarch when Delaney had gone over to Jack's to confer with him about the accident, and Delaney had thought it odd that Jack didn't offer to take him into another room or out onto the patio where they could talk in private. Jack took no notice of his son. He might just as well have been a part of the furniture. He put an arm round Delaney's shoulder, made him a drink, listened to his story, and assured him that he had nothing to worry about, nothing at all. If the man was legal, why would he refuse aid? And if he was illegal, what were the chances he'd find an attorney to represent him, and on what grounds?
"But Jack," Delaney had protested, "I didn't report the accident."
Jack had turned to him, calm and complicitous.
"What accident?" he said. And he was the most reasonable man in the world, judge, jury, and advocate all rolled into one. "You stopped and offered to help. The man refused assistance. What more could you do?"
Indeed. But now Jack Jr. wanted to know, and the thought of it made Delaney's stomach sink. There were five people in the world who knew what had happened out on that road, and by luck of the draw, Jack Jr. was one of them.
"Yeah," he said.
"What of it?"
"Oh, nothing. I was just wondering where it happened. You said they were camping and all."
"Out on the canyon road. Why?"
"Oh, I don't know." Jack Jr. kicked at something in the dirt.
"I was just wondering. I see an awful lot of them down there lately. You said it was down below the lumberyard, right? Where that trail cuts off into the ravine?"
For the life of him, Delaney couldn't grasp what the boy was getting at. What was it to him?
But he answered the question almost reflexively. He had nothing to hide.
"Right," he said. And then he got to his feet, murmured, "Well, I gotta be going," and strode off into the darkness, fingering the sorry lump of flesh in his jacket pocket. He made a mental note to put it in the freezer when he got home. It would begin to stink before long.
4. The morning after America climbed up out of the canyon to offer herself at the labor exchange, futilely, as it turned out, she insisted on going again. Candido was against it, vehemently. The day before, he'd waited through the slow-crawling morning till the sun stood directly overhead, 12 noon, the hour at which the labor exchange closed down for the day. And then he'd waited another hour, and another, torn by worry and suspicion. If she'd somehow managed to get work, she might not be back till dark. And that was almost worse than if she hadn't, what with the worry. And worse still, the shame. He kept picturing her in some rich man's house, down on her knees, scrubbing one of those tiled kitchens with a refrigerator the size of a meat locker, and one of those dark-faced ovens that boil water in 60 seconds, and the rich man watching her ass as it waved in the air and trembled with the hard push of her shoulders. Finally, and it must have been 3 in the afternoon, she appeared, a dark speck creeping over the sun-bleached rocks, and in her hand one of those thin plastic market bags the gringos use once and throw away. Candido had to squint to see her against the pain that filmed his eyes. "Where were you?" he demanded when she was close enough to hear him. And then, in a weaker voice, a voice of apology and release, "Did you get work?" No smile. That gave him his answer. But she did hand him the bag as an offering and kneel down on the blanket to kiss the good side of his face like a dutiful wife. In the bag, 2 overripe tomatoes, 6 hard greenish oranges, and a turnip stained black with the earth. He sucked the sour oranges and ate a stew made from the turnip and tomatoes. He didn't ask her where she'd gotten them. And now she wanted to go again. It was the same ritual as the day before, slipping from the blanket like a thief, pulling the one good dress over her head, combing out her hair by the stream. It was dark still. The night clung to them like a second skin. No bird had even begun to breathe.
"Where are you going?" he croaked.
2 words out of the darkness, and they cut him to the quick. To work. He sat up and railed while she built the fire and made him coffee and some rice pap with sugar to ease the pain of his chewing, and he told her his fears, outlined the wickedness of the gabacho world and the perfidy of his fellow braceros at the labor exchange, tried to work the kind of apprehension into her heart that would make her stay here with him, where it was safe, but she wouldn't listen. Or rather, she listened. "I'm afraid," she told him, "afraid of this place and the people in it, afraid to walk out on the street." But it had no effect. He forbade her to go, roared out his rage till his indented cheekbone was on fire, got up on unsteady legs and threatened her with his balled-up fist, but it did no good. She hung her head, wouldn't look him in the eye. "Someone has to go," she whispered. "In a day or two you'll be better. But now you couldn't even get up the trail, let alone work, and that's if there's work." What could he say? She was gone. And then the day began, and the boredom set in. Boredom that almost made him glad of the pain in his face, his hip, his arm. At least it was something. At least it was a distraction. He looked round the little clearing by the stream, and the leaves, the rocks, the spill of the slope above him, and even the sun in the sky seemed unchanging, eternal, as dead as a photograph. For all its beauty, this place was a jail cell, and he was a prisoner, incarcerated in his thoughts. But even a prisoner had something to read, a radio maybe. A place to sit and take a contemplative crap. Work. They made license plates here in Gringolandia. They broke rocks. But at least they did something. He dozed, woke, dozed again. And every time he looked up at the sun, it was in the same place in the sky, fixed there as if time had stood still. America was out there. Anything could happen to her. How could he rest? How could he have a moment's peace with that specter before him? America. The thought of her brought her face back to him, her wide, innocent face, the face of a child still, with the eyes that bled into you and the soft, lisping breath of a voice that was like the first voice you'd ever heard. He'd known her since she was a little girl, 4 years old, the youngest sister of his wife, Resurrección. She was a flower girl at the wedding, and she looked like a flower herself, blossoming brown limbs in the white petals of her dress. He took the vows with Resurrección that day, and he was 20 years old, just back from 9 months in El Norte, working the potato fields in Idaho and the citrus in Arizona, and he was like a god in Tepoztlan. In 9 months he had made more and sent half of it home via gyros than his father in his leather shop had made in a lifetime. Resurrección had promised to wait for him when he left, and she was good to her word. That time, at least. But each year the wait got longer, and she changed. They all changed, all the wives, and who could blame them? For 3/4 of the year, the villages of Morelos became villages of women, all but deserted by the men who had migrated north to earn real money and work 8 and 10 and 12 hours a day instead of sitting in the cantina eternally nursing a beer. A few men stayed behind, of course, the ones who had businesses, the congenitally rich, the crazies, and some of them, the unscrupulous ones, took advantage of the loneliness of the forlorn and itching wives to put horns on the heads of the men breaking their backs in the land of the gringos. Señor González is what they called these ghouls of the disinterred marriage, or sometimes just Sancho, as in, Sancho bedded your wife. There was even a verb for it, sanchear, to slip in like a weasel and make a cabron out of an unoffending and blameless man. And so, after 7 seasons away and 6 cold winters at home, during which he felt like half a man because Resurrección would not take his seed no matter what they tried, and they tried Chinese positions, chicken fat rubbed on the womb during intercourse, herbs and potions from the curandera, and injections from the doctor. Cándido came home to find that his wife was living in Cuernavaca with a Sancho by the name of Teófilo Aguadulce. She was 6 months pregnant, and she'd spent all the money Cándido had sent her on her Sancho and his unquenchable thirst for beer, pulque, and distilled spirits. America was the one who broke the news to him. Cándido came in the door at his father-in-law's place, bearing gifts, jubilant in his return, the all-conquering hero, benefactor of half the village, the good nephew who'd built his mother's sister a new house and had a brand-new boombox radio in his bag for her even now, and there was no one home but America. 11 years old and shy as a jaguar with a pig clenched in its jaws. "Cándido," she screamed, throwing herself in his arms. "What did you bring for me?" He'd brought her a glass Christmas bowl with the figure of a gabacho Santa Claus imprisoned in it, an artificial snow that inundated him with a blizzard when you turned it upside down. But where was everybody? A pause, release of the limbs, a restrained dance round the room with the inverted Christmas bowl. "They didn't want to see you." "What? Didn't want to see him?" She was joking, pulling his leg, very funny. "Where's Resurrección?" Then came his season in hell. He took the first bus to Cuernavaca, sought out Teófilo Aguadulce's house, and beat on the closed shutters till his hands were raw. He prowled the streets, haunted the cantinas, the markets, the cinema, but there was no sign of them. Finally, a week later, Cándido got word that Teófilo Aguadulce was coming to Tepoztlán to see his ailing grandfather. And when he crossed the plaza at 12 noon, Cándido was waiting for him. With half the village looking on, Cándido called him out. And he would have had his revenge, too, and his honor, if the son of a bitch hadn't got the better of him with a perfidious wrestling move that left him stunned and bleeding in the dirt. No one said a word. No one reached down a hand to help him up. His friends and neighbors, the people he'd known all his life, simply turned their backs on him and walked away. Cándido got drunk. And when he sobered up, he got drunk again. And again. He was too ashamed to go back to his aunt's, and so he wandered the hills, sleeping where he fell, till his clothes turned to rags and he stank like a goat. Children pelted him with rocks and made up songs about him, rhymes to skip rope by, and the keening of their voices burned into him like a rawhide whip. He made for the border, finally, to lose himself in the north, But the coyote was a fool, and the U.S. immigration caught him before he'd gone 100 yards and pitched him back into the dark fastness of the Tijuana night. He was broke, and he danced for people on the streets there, begged change from turistas, got himself a can of kerosene, and became a tragafuegos, a street-corner fire-breather who sacrificed all sensation in his lips, tongue, and palate for a few centavos and a few centavos more. What he made, he spent on drink. When his fall was complete, when he'd scraped every corner of himself raw, he came back to Tepoztlan and moved in with his aunt in the house he'd built for her. He made charcoal for a living, climbed into the hills every morning, cut wood and slow-burned it for sale to housewives as fuels for their braziers and the stoves they'd made out of old Pemex barrels. He did nothing else. He saw no one. And then one day he ran across America in the street, and everything changed. "Don't you know me?" she demanded. And he didn't know her, not at first. She was 16, and she looked exactly like her sister, only better. He set down the bundle of sticks he was carrying and straightened out his back with an abbreviated twist. "You're America," he said. And then he gave it a minute as a car came up the road scattering chickens and sending an explosion of pigeons into the air. "And I'm going to take you with me when I go north." That was what he thought about as he lay there in the ravine, fragile as a peeled egg. That was what America meant to him. Just his life, that was all. And that was why he was worried, edgy, afraid, deeply afraid for the first time in as long as he could remember. What if something should happen to her? What if the immigration caught her? What if some gabacho hit her with his car? What if one of the vagos from the labor exchange? But he didn't like to think about them. They were too close to him. It was too much to hold in his aching head. The sun had ridden up over the eastern ridge. The heat was coming on faster than it had during the past week, the mist burning off sooner. There would be winds in the afternoon, and the canyon walls would hold the heat like the walls of an oven. He could feel the change of the weather in his hip, his elbow, the crushed side of his face. The sun crept across the sand and hit him in the crotch, the chest, his chin, lips, and ravaged nose. He closed his eyes and let himself drift. When he woke, he was thirsty. Not just thirsty, consumed with thirst, maddened by it. His clothes were wet, the blanket beneath him damp with his sweat. With an effort, he pushed himself up and staggered into the shade where America kept their drinking water in two plastic milk jugs from which he'd cut the tops with his worn-out switchblade. He snatched up the near jug and lifted air to his lips. It was empty. So was the other one. His throat constricted. He knew better than to drink the water straight from the stream, and he'd warned America about it, too. Every drop had to be boiled first. It was a pain in the ass, gathering wood, stoking the fire, setting the blackened can on the coals, but it was necessary. America had balked at first. Why go to the trouble? This was the USA, plumbing capital of the world, the land of filtration plants and water purifiers and chlorine, and everyone knew of the gringo fascination with toilets. How could the water be unsafe, here of all places? But it was. He'd been here before, in this very spot, and he'd been sick from it. Could she even begin to imagine how many septic fields drained off of those mountains, he demanded? Or how many houses were packed up there all the way to the asshole of the canyon, and every one of them leaching waste out into the gullies and streams that fed into the creek? He knew better than to drink the water, but he did. He was dying. He was dried out like the husk of something washed up at high tide and left for a month in the sun, dried out like a fig, a soda cracker. It was beyond him even to contemplate gathering up twigs, searching for a scrap of paper, the matches, waiting till the water boiled for 5 full minutes and then waiting for it to cool, way beyond him. Mad with thirst, crazed, demented, he threw himself down in the sand, plunged his face into the algal scum of the pool beneath him and drank till he nearly drowned himself. Finally, his stomach swollen like a boater bag, he lay back, sated, and the afternoon went on, and he dozed and worried and suffered his wounds, only to wake and worry and suffer again. It amazed him how quickly the shits came. When he'd drunk from the creek, the sun had been just east of overhead, and now it had settled a degree or two to the west, but it was still high and still hot. What did that add up to? 2 hours? 3? But there it was, the stirring in his gut, the cramping, the desperate, uncontainable rush that every man, woman, and child knew so intimately in his country. A poor, underdeveloped place in which sanitation was a luxury and gastrointestinal infection the leading cause of death. Candido had just enough time to get across the stream and behind the cluster of great splintered boulders he and America used as a privy before it came. And when it came in an explosion, a raging cataract of shit that left him drained in an instant, and then it hit him again and again till he lost the strength of his legs and collapsed in the sand like a puppet with the strings cut. Lying there, coated in sweat and sand and worse, his trousers ballooning round his ankles, he heard the first sharp cries from above, gabacho-accented cries, and he knew it was over. They were coming for him. They'd got hold of America, and she'd told him where he was. Ay, caray, what a mess! How could he run, half-crippled, bestrewn with shit? And even now he could feel his guts churning again. And America, where was America? He mouthed a prayer to the Virgen Sagrada and became one with the rocks. America sat in the shade of the wall-less shelter the gringos had built to keep the itinerant job-seekers out of the sun, and, coincidentally, off the street, out of the post office parking lot and out of sight, and brooded about Candido. He was too stubborn to think she could help. Too much the boss, the man, the patron. He treated her like a child, a know-nothing, someone who needed to be led by the hand and protected from all the evils of the world. Well, she had news for him. She was no longer a child. Did children bear children? In 5 months she'd be a mother, and then what? And while this new place terrified her, the whole country, the gringos with their superior ways and their almighty dollar and their new clothes and fancy hairdos, the strange customs, the language, it was like the incessant braying of a four-legged beast. She was doing what she had to do, and she could look out for herself. She could. After sitting in the corner all day yesterday, afraid to talk to anyone, she'd screwed up her courage this morning and gone straight to the man in charge and told him her name and asked for work. Of course, if he'd been a gringo, she never would have had the nerve to open her mouth, and he wouldn't have understood her anyway. But this man was a campesino from Oaxaca, in battered jeans and a molded straw hat, like the men in Tepoztlan wore, and he used the familiar with her right away, and even called her daughter. There must have been 50 or 60 men there, at least, and they all stopped talking when she went up to the man from Oaxaca. No one seemed to take notice of her when she was off by herself, hunched beside a stump in the dawn, miserable like the rest of them, but now she felt as if she were on stage. The men were staring at her, every one of them, some openly, some furtively, their eyes ducking for cover beneath the brims of their sombreros and baseball caps, whenever she looked up. Of all that mob, she was the only woman. And though she felt uneasy under their collective gaze, and nervous, too, to think that women must not get jobs here if she was the only one, she felt a strange sense of peace as she spoke to the head man in his battered jeans. She didn't know what it was at first, but then it hit her. All these faces were familiar. Not literally, of course, but they were the faces of her own people, her tribe, the faces she'd grown up with, and that was a comfort in itself. The head man's name was Candelario Perez. He looked to be in his 40s, and he was squat and work-hardened. He'd been informally elected by the others to keep order, making sure the men waited their turn instead of mobbing every pickup that pulled into the lot, clean up the trash, and mediate between the workers and the gringos of the community who'd donated the land and the lumber for the sake of the hungry and homeless. "There's not much work for women here, daughter," he said, and she could see the tug of sympathy in his eyes. He didn't know her from anybody, and yet he cared. She could see that. "Doesn't anyone in these big houses need a stove cleaned or a floor mopped? Doesn't that ever happen?" All the men were watching her. Traffic, amazing traffic, wind past on the canyon road 40, 50 miles an hour, bumper to bumper, with barely room to breathe in between. Candelario Perez gave her a long look. "We'll see, daughter, we'll see," he said. And then he showed her where to sit, pointing to the corner she'd occupied now for 3 hours and more. She was bored. She was frightened. What if she didn't get work? Not today? Not ever? What would they eat? What would her baby do for clothes, shelter, nourishment? And this place, wasn't it the perfect spot for La Migra to come in their puke-green trucks and tan shirts and demand documents, la tarjeta verde, a birth certificate, driver's license, social security card? What was stopping them? It would be like shooting fish in a barrel. As each car pulled into the lot and two or three men gathered round it, she held her breath in hope and fear, wanting work, desperately wanting it, yet mortally afraid of the bland white faces of the men staring out from behind the windshield. What exactly did they want? What were the rules? Were they from immigration? Were they perverts, rapists, murderers? Or were they good people, decent, rich people who needed help with a baby, with laundry, with the pots and pans and the ironing? As it turned out, it didn't matter. She sat there from dawn till noon, and she didn't get work. At 11 or so, she had no way of telling the time exactly. A big gringa with wild, dead-metal hair and eyes the color of a Coke bottle came up the canyon road with a strange, jerking gait, passed through the open-air building like a zombie, and threw herself down in the dirt beside America. It was hot already, 90 at least. And yet the woman was dressed in the heavy brocade you might find on a sofa in a house of easy virtue, and she wore a shawl of the same material round her shoulders. When she got close, America could see the thin wire loop that punctured her right nostril. "How you doing?" the woman said. "I'm Mary. Llama Mary?" "Me llamo America," America returned. "Habla usted español?" Mary grinned. Her teeth were enormous, like cow's teeth, more yellow than white. "Poco," she said. "Little." "No work today, huh? You know, work, trabaja." Work. Was this woman offering her work? America's heart began to race, but then she caught herself. She didn't look like a housewife, this woman, not the kind America knew from the North American films and TV. She looked dirty, and she had the sad smell of poverty about her. "I'm looking, too," the woman said, and she punched a thumb into her own chest for emphasis. "Me? I work. Trabaja? Clean house, paint, odd jobs, comprendo? Sometimes get, sometimes no. You sabe?" America didn't sabe, nor did she understand. Was this woman trying to tell her that she, a gringa in her own country, was looking for the same work as America? It couldn't be. It was a fantasy. Crazy. But Mary persisted. She made wiping motions with her hands, cleaned an imaginary window, even making little squeaking sounds to imitate the pressure of the rag and the release of the ammonia. And she dipped her imaginary rag into an imaginary bucket until America got the idea. She was a criada, a maid, a cleaning lady, here in her own country, and as fantastic as it seemed, she was competing for the same non-existent jobs America was. Well, it was a shock. Like seeing that gabacho with the long hair in Venice begging on the streets. America felt all the hope crumple in her. And then the gringa, Mary, was digging around inside her clothes as if she were scratching fleas or something, actually squirming in the dirt. But it wasn't a flea she came up with. It was a bottle. Pint size. She took a long swallow and laughed, then offered it to America. "No," America gestured, shaking her head, and she was thinking, "Have I sunk to this, a good student and a good girl who always respected her parents and did as she was told, sitting here penniless in the dirt with a common drunk?" "Excuse, please," she said, and got up to seek out Candelario Perez to see if there was anything for her. She couldn't find him. It was too late. By arrangement with the local citizens, the labor exchange closed down at noon. They might have been liberal and motivated by a spirit of common humanity and charity, but they didn't want a perpetual encampment of the unemployed, out of luck and foreign in their midst. 12 o'clock came and you went home, unless you were lucky enough to have found a job for the day, and then you went home when the boss told you to go. They were very strict about camping in the ravine or in the brush along the road, not only the gringos, but men like Candelario Perez, who knew that one encampment could ruin it for them all. There was nothing to stop the gringos from tearing down this building and calling in the cops and the hard-faced men from the INS. America knew nothing of this, and that was a small mercy. She did know that it was noon and that the gathering was breaking up voluntarily. She walked aimlessly round the lot. Cars went by on the canyon road, but fewer of them now and at greater intervals. There was a gas station, a second-hand clothing store. Across the street, the post office, and then the little shopping center where the paisano from Italy had his store. The men were staring at her openly now, and their stares were harder, hungrier. Most of them were here alone, separated from their families and their wives for months at a time, sometimes years. They were starving, and she was fresh meat. The image spooked her, and she started off down the road, conscious of their eyes drilling into her. All the warmth she'd felt earlier, the familiarity, the brother and sisterhood, was gone suddenly, and all she could think of, looming nightmarishly, was the faces of those animals at the border, Mexican animals, the ones who'd come out of the night to attack her and Candido as they'd crossed over. Mexicans, her own people, and when the light hit them, their faces showed nothing, no respect, no mercy, nothing. America had been terrified to begin with. What she and Candido were doing was illegal, and she'd never done anything illegal in her life. Crouching there beside the corrugated iron fence, her mouth dry and heart racing, she waited through the long night till the coyote gave the word, and then she and Candido and half a dozen others were running for their lives in the hard-baked earth of another country. 2/3 of their savings had gone to this man, this coyote, this emissary between the two worlds, and he was either incompetent or he betrayed them. 1 minute he was there, hustling them through a gap in the fence, and the next minute he was gone, leaving them in a clump of bushes at the bottom of a ravine in a darkness so absolute it was like being thrust into the bottom of a well. And then the animals jumped them, just like that, a gang of them, armed with knives, baseball bats, a pistol. And how did they know that she and Candida would be there, beneath that particular bush, and at the ungodly hour of 4 a.m.? There were 6 or 7 of them. They pinned Candido down and cut the pockets from his trousers, and then, in that hot, subterranean darkness, they went for her. A knife was in her face. Their hands were all over her, and they jerked the clothes from her as if they were skinning a rabbit. Candido cried out, and they clubbed him. She screamed, and they laughed. But then, just as the first one loosened his belt, taking his time, enjoying it, the helicopter came with its lights, and suddenly it was bright day, and the vermin were scattering. And Candido had her, and the wash of the propellers threw the dirt against her bare skin like 1,000 hot needles. "Run!" Candido screamed. "Run!" And she ran, naked, her feet sliced by the rocks and the stabbing talons of the desert plants. But she couldn't outrun a helicopter. That was the most humiliating night of her life. She was herded along with 100 other people toward a line of Border Patrol jeeps, and she stood there naked and bleeding, every eye on her, until someone gave her a blanket to cover herself. 20 minutes later, she was back on the other side of the fence. Bitter reflections. She continued down the road, thinking to duck off onto one of the hilly side streets to her right, as she'd done yesterday. There were backyard gardens there, fruit trees, tomatoes and peppers and squash. She didn't mean to steal. She knew it was wrong. And she'd never stolen a thing in her life. Until yesterday. The voices echoed through the confined space of the ravine as if it were a public bath, high-pitched with excitement, almost squealing. "Hey, look, didn't I tell you? What, you find something? What the fuck do you think that is? A fucking fireplace, and look, a fucking blanket!" Candido crouched there behind the rocks, afraid to breathe, trembling as uncontrollably as if he'd suddenly been plunged into an ice bath, and all he could think of was America. He'd been caught 3 times before. Once in L.A., once in Arizona, and then with America, just over the Tijuana fence. And the fear of that took his breath away and turned his stomach over yet again. It wasn't himself he was afraid for, it was her. For him it was nothing. A pain in the ass, sure, a bus ride to the border, his meager possessions scattered to the winds. But how would he get back to his wife? 180 miles and no money, not a cent. There might be a beating. The gabachos could be brutal, big men with little blonde mustaches and hate in their eyes, but usually they were just bored, just going through the motions. A beating he could take, even now with his face and his arm and the shit pouring out of him, but it was America he trembled for. What would happen to her? How would he find her? If they'd caught her already, at the labor exchange, walking along the road, she could be on a bus even now. And worse, if they hadn't caught her and she came back here, back to nothing, what then? She'd think he'd deserted her, run off from his responsibilities like a cock on the loose, and what love could survive that? They should have made a contingency plan, figured out a place to meet in Tijuana, a signal of some kind. But they hadn't. He listened to the voices and gritted his teeth. "Hey, dude, check this out!" "What?" "Look at this shit!" "But wait a minute. These weren't the voices of INS agents, of the police, of grown men. No, there was something in the timbre, something harsh and callow in the way the words seemed to claw for air as if they were choking on them, something adolescent." Candido stealthily pushed himself to a sitting position, pulled up his trousers and crept forward on hands and knees to a place where he could peer between the rocks without being detected. What he saw got him breathing again. 2 figures, no uniforms. Baggy shorts, high-top sneakers, big black billowing T-shirts, legs and arms pale in the slashing sun as they bent to his things, lifted them above their heads and flung them one by one into the creek. First the blanket, then the grill he'd salvaged from an abandoned refrigerator, then his rucksack with his comb and toothbrush and a change of clothes inside, and then America's things.
"Shit, man, one of them's a girl," the bigger one said, holding up America's everyday dress, blue cotton washed so many times it was almost white.
In that moment, Candido confirmed what his ears had suspected. These weren't men. They were boys, overgrown boys. The one holding the dress out before him was 6 feet at least, towering all limbs and feet, and with a head shaved to the ears, and gabacho-colored hair gone long on top. Redheads, did they all have to be redheads? Fucking beaners. Rip it up, man. Destroy it. The other one was shorter, big in the shoulders and chest, and with the clear, glassy cat's eyes so many of the gringos inherited from their mothers, the gringas from Sweden and Holland and places like that. He had a mean, pinched face, the face of an insect under the magnifying glass, bland at a distance, lethal up close. The bigger one tore the dress in two, balled the halves and flung them at the other one, and they hooted and capered up and down the stream bed like apes that had dropped from the trees. Before they were done, they even bent to the rocks of the fireplace Candido had built and heaved them into the stream, too. Candido waited a long while before emerging. They'd been gone half an hour at least, their shrieks and obscenities riding on up the walls of the canyon till finally they blended with the distant hum of the traffic and faded away. His stomach heaved on him again, and he had to crouch down with the pain of it, but the spasm passed. After a moment, he got up and waded into the stream to try to recover his things, and it was then that he noticed their parting gift, a message emblazoned on the rocks in paint that dripped like blood. The letters were crude, and the words in English, but there was no mistaking the meaning. Beaners die.
5.
Delaney couldn't feel bad for long, not up here where the night hung close round him and the crickets thundered and the air off the Pacific crept up the hills to drive back the lingering heat of the day. There were even stars, a cluster here and there, fighting through the wash of light pollution that turned the eastern and southern borders of the night yellow, as if a whole part of the world had gone rancid. To the north and east lay the San Fernando Valley, a single endless plain of parallel boulevards, houses, mini-malls, and streetlights. And to the south lay the rest of Los Angeles, ad infinitum. There were no streetlights in Arroyo Blanco. That was one of the attractions, the rural feel, the sense that you were somehow separated from the city and wedded to the mountains. And Delaney never felt the lack of them. He didn't carry a flashlight, either. He enjoyed making his way through the dark streets, his eyes adjusting to the shapes and shadows of the world as it really was, reveling in the way the night defined itself in the absence of artificial light and the ubiquitous blast of urban noise. Though the walk had calmed him, he couldn't suppress a sudden pounding in his chest as he passed the DeGolian place, heedless people, slobs, and turned up Pinon Drive, conscious once again of the burden in the pocket of his windbreaker. His house sat at the end of Pinon in a cul-de-sac that marked the last frontier of urban development, and the chirring of the crickets seemed louder here, the darkness more complete. As if to prove the point, a great horned owl began to hoot softly from the trees behind him. Someone's sprinklers went on with a hiss. High overhead, a jet climbing out of LAX cut a tear in the sky. Delaney had just begun to relax again when a car suddenly turned into the street from Robles Drive, high beams obliterating the night. He glanced over his shoulder, squinted into the light, and kept on walking. The car was moving, but barely. Its exhaust rumbled menacingly, all that horsepower held in check, and from behind the rolled-up windows came the bottom-heavy thump of rap music. No words, no instrument, no melody discernible, just a thump. Delaney kept walking, annoyed all over again. Why couldn't they pass by already and let the night close back over him? Why couldn't he have a minute's peace even in his own neighborhood? The car pulled slowly alongside him, and he could see that it was some sort of American car, older, a big boat of a thing with mag wheels and an elaborate metal flake paint job. The windows were smoked, and he couldn't see inside. What did they want, directions? No face was visible. No one asked. He cursed under his breath, then picked up his pace, but the car seemed to hover there beside him, the speakers sucking up all available sound and then pumping it back out again, ka-thump, ka-thump, ka-thump. The car stayed even with him for what seemed an eternity.